Everybody, this is Sam McEwen. This is the Pick Six Podcast. Hello, everyone. This is Thursday, January 21st. It is unseasonably warm outside and unseasonably quiet around Nebraska athletics. Sort of the calm before the storm in terms of volleyball, which starts tomorrow on Friday. We're not going to talk a bunch of volleyball today, but it does start the season of the best team on campus. Nebraska basketball is quiet during a COVID pause. We'll talk a little bit about that. And of course, Husker football is just at the beginning of the 2021 season, which begins technically with winter conditioning and moves beyond that. Scott Frost talking on the radio last night. We will have some thoughts on what he had to say, and then we're going to take a few and answer a few questions that we got off of Twitter. I'm here, so is Tom Chattel, Dirk Chatelain, and Evan Bland. And we'll talk with Evan a little bit about Big Ten baseball, because it looks like the league is going to embrace a conference-only schedule, and in doing that is going to rely on the reputation of its league to help bolster any postseason chances it would have. And newsflash, Big Ten baseball is not like Big Ten volleyball. So they're not quite the same operation. So the reputation is a little bit different when it comes to baseball. And Evan wrote a nice story that ran in the, it ran online today. I don't know if it ran in the paper, but it definitely ran online. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And of course, we will take your questions. As always, we start off our podcast by letting you know that we are sponsored by the Schwalbach Agency. Team Schwalbach is a family-owned Allstate insurance agency with four licensed insurance pros saving thousands of Nebraska Husker fans money. They sell homeowner, auto, life, flood insurance across Nebraska, and they also insure all the big boy toys. Not a lot are in use at this moment. Motorcycles, boats, RVs, off-road vehicles. I did see a couple of motorcycles yesterday when it was about 53 here in Lincoln. If you've had a roof replaced in the last 5 years, give Daryl Schwalbach, Kyle Schwalbach, Nancy Mossack, or Kyle Merrick a call at 402-590-5200. They can help you save a bundle. Free, no obligation insurance reviews and quotes. They're going to make sure all of the Nebraska Fell fans are properly protected. You can contact them again at www.nebraskaallstate.com or again, 402-590-5200, 402-590-5200. Thanks to Team Schwalbach. Okay, Scott Frost talked on the radio last night. He covered many, many topics. He covered why they didn't play in a bowl game, that they didn't have unanimity among the players. We know that it was mostly offensive players that didn't want to play in the bowl game. He talked about the spring game being moved to May 1st to accommodate a later schedule, which will give them a full winter conditioning slate and then spring football camp in April. Maybe the pandemic will be under control by then. He talked a little bit about the transfer of Wandale Robinson. He talked a lot more about the additions of Marquis Stepp and Samari Touré, and he talked about a few other things. Anything jump out to you guys off the top about Frost's 15-minute chat on Sports Nightly?
Well, I would say the idea of the spring game being May 1st is pretty interesting, and it makes a lot of sense, right? Just because recruiting is still in a dead period through April 15th. And usually that's the motivation, is to schedule these spring games on the front end so you can get out as a coaching staff and recruit. But in this case, you might as well push it back as far as you can. You get the full winter conditioning. Hopefully the pandemic's more under control so you can get back out on the recruiting trail at some point after that. Maybe the spring game can be a recruiting tool in and of itself again, after missing out on that last year. So it's just, I think it's kind of interesting to look ahead and see what the month of April could look like around Nebraska and into May, with the volleyball team playing, with football continuing later than usual. You know, we don't know what baseball and softball would look like. It just sets up, I think, a really interesting spring. And personally, I don't mind it moving back a little bit and giving those guys a little bit more of a break, having a little bit more of a pause between football and then seeing what this team looks like in a few months. But I think with the pandemic and all the uncertainty, I thought it was a good move. Made a lot of sense to move that thing as far down the road as you can.
And talking to Mike Farrell at Rivals, he does not believe that April 15th will be the day when recruiting opens back up, by the way. I think there's an expectation in the college coaching community that won't be until May, and that they might get camp season, but they're probably not getting that April 15th date. And so I think there's an understanding that if you move things to May 1st, you're really not going to be losing anything on the recruiting trail. I think that might have something to do with why they're willing to move it back the extra 2 weeks. Anyone else?
Well, Sam, I was struck by his comments about the new players, not so much individually, but just sort of the tone that, hey, this is college football, and you tip your hat and move on. And the days of being nostalgic and weepy for players who decide they're not in your program anymore are kind of by the wayside. Yeah. There's so much movement now that you just can't afford to rely too much on one player. I mean, especially when it's not a quarterback. So, I just thought the comments last night were sort of indicative of the new world of college football, one that is hard to accept. But as a coach, I think you don't have much choice.
Yeah, free agency is here. What do you think, Tom?
Yeah, I think he had to say that too. I mean, you don't want to be – you can't sound bitter as a coach because you also want guys to come to you. I mean, he's getting Marquis Step. So, I mean, somebody leaves, somebody comes. It's just it's Dirk said, it's the way of the world, and – you know, you can't come off. You don't want to be a guy who's going to sound upset with players. You want it to be sort of a welcoming, environment. So, it is what it is, sort of. But I did. You know, other than that, I didn't think there was a lot, going on. I mean, you talked about the bowl game while you didn't play, and. Same coaching staff, special teams. He wants to be good on special teams. We've heard that a million times. So, at this point, there's not a lot to say. There's a lot to ask. There's probably not a lot to say.
Yeah. Yeah, Scott will always, I think, will always have a medium or middle moderate approach to the transfer portal and transferring in general, because he himself was a transfer, and you can't not remember that. So like, it's part of his story, and it's a great part of his story. Like, he benefited from transferring more than almost any player I can imagine who isn't named Baker Mayfield or Kyler Murray. I mean, that's how much Scott benefited from transferring. So it was an absolute good for him to come.
Sam, I would argue he benefited more than those guys, because I think those guys probably would have panned out had they stayed where they were. Scott was going nowhere at Stanford had he stayed. So I think you could make an argument that, and maybe we should at some point, that he benefited more from transferring than maybe any college football player ever.
Zach Taylor was up there too. He left Wake Forest, went to some JUCO, comes to Nebraska, gets to know Bill Callahan, and he's an NFL head coach now. And I don't think that happens unless he meets Bill. And then met Mike Sherman, and then Mike Sherman's daughter. Yeah, right, there it goes. Anyway, that helped too. So, I've always think that's going to be part of Frost's story, and I'm not a Pollyanna. I think they got two pretty good players. I think Step probably isn't quite as good, in my opinion, as Mills, but we'll see. My opinion of Mills is probably higher than most. And then I think Samari Toure can give them something that they actually didn't have. Now, one of the questions that I asked in one of my ramblings over the last week or so is, does this program have the kind of big people, and by that I mean tight ends and big receivers, that makes them worry maybe a little less about whether they can find a 5'10" slot receiver? I think the words duck R are imprinted on the back of my brain, and I'm not saying that that's not an important position, but when you look around and you look at some of the other teams in the league, you see them embracing the kind of players who grow up in this region. And I think Nebraska might be doing the same. They might be embracing the fact that the one thing you can get in the Midwest is tight ends and linebackers. And so you build your team around tight ends and linebackers. And I feel like they're starting to do that.
Yeah. It's going to take a philosophical shift though, isn't it? I mean, because I think Scott Frost, will have a hard time letting go of being the fastest team on the field, especially on offense. And, you know, I don't just mean fastest in terms of 40 speed, but also, you know, in terms of pace on offense. And I think that's really, we've talked about it before, but that's an identity issue that he really has to wrestle with, I think, in the next 3 or 4 months, is how do I adapt this offense to, you know, to give my defense a chance to carry the team. And I don't know if he'll have to worry about that same problem in 2022, but it's certainly, I think, one of the prominent issues in this calendar year.
He talked about letting go of special teams analyst Jonathan Rutledge. Now, that was done a while ago, but it made official, I think, last Thursday when we were on this podcast, or Friday or whenever that was. That was made official last week, but he'd done it a while ago. Rutledge is the rare special teams analyst that then wanted to do interviews with the media. And I think his thought process was striking in the sense that he felt like Frost probably wasn't as engaged on special teams as he was on the offense, and that he thought that Nebraska needed a full-time special teams coordinator. Nebraska then promptly opened up a special teams analyst job. So I don't know what that means exactly. I don't know if that means that they're going to hire a coordinator and an analyst, or they're going to give the coordinator title to somebody already on the staff, or if they're going to, if they hire a full-time coordinator who isn't currently on the staff, they have to let someone go, which means conflict. And you know, that's not something that Nebraska is all that comfortable with. They're not, I think they're not always great with something bad has to happen in order for something better to happen. And that's something that I've seen a reticence.
Sam, I just want to state the obvious. If it really is maintained, if it continues to be an analyst role, I think you should definitely apply for that job. I mean, you've broken Nebraska's analyst. You've analyzed Nebraska's special teams woes.
No.
Better than anybody possibly could. You know, I just think you're sort of tailor-made for it.
Uh-huh. No.
You know what, Sam? Every one of these coaches, I assume, knows football, okay?
Yeah.
They all know special teams. This is not rocket science. Special teams is not rocket science, okay? I mean, when Nebraska was better than anybody at this stuff, Dan Young, a great man, assistant offensive line coach, was the head of special teams. I mean, but they all coached it. The head coach has to be in charge of special teams. He's got to be in charge of basically all this stuff. And then he dog gates down. But it's got to be a priority. I just don't think it's a priority. I don't get the – I mean, and as far as, you know, shuffling the staff, do you need a quarterback coach, offensive coordinator, and a head coach of those quarterbacks? I'm asking. It's a good question. Especially when the quarterbacks have not developed well. So maybe you do, but you need to do it better. But I don't think special team. I think we're kind of overthinking this. I mean, but in terms of an analyst, every one of these guys has to. They all have to help, and I don't know. It's just. I don't say comical because I don't think anybody's laughing, but it shouldn't be this hard.
No, yeah. You shouldn't.
I mean, I feel like there are a lot of ways Nebraska can do it. To me, going with another analyst makes probably the least sense, but just from the outside looking in. But you look at the way the assistants are structured. There's a lot of ways they could move things around to accommodate an on the field guy leading that. I mean, like you said, Tom, there seems like there's maybe some redundancy when you have a quarterback coach, an offensive coordinator, and then your head coach is the guy calling plays. You know, a lot of teams don't have an inside linebackers coach and an outside linebackers coach. One of those could, maybe Mike Dawson, who has some experience there, could conceivably be a special teams guy. Like, there are a lot of different ways. No, this doesn't have to be a situation where somebody gets fired or whatever. Like, there are other ways that they could get an on-field guy there. It's fascinating to me that it might not go that way, that you would bring in Jonathan Rutledge, who helped bring in, your punter, Daniel Cerny, who everyone's high on, who helped bring in Connor Culp. And then you bring in a different guy because the first guy wasn't able to do what he needed to do on the field, but he couldn't be on the field. Like, it just, it seems odd to me that that would be the way it would go, but I don't know. I guess my point is that there's enough flexibility in that staff that they could probably find a way to do it without creating conflict, as we've said.
You know, this speaks to me, this speaks to just the overall atmosphere on the program of little things have to matter. And they until they get the things, we talk about identity all we want, but identity of the program has to be get the little things cleaned up. Stop getting it in your own way. Stop tripping over your own feet. And a special team just kind of falls in that category of do the little things right all the time. And they don't do those things well. And that, so that needs to be cleaned up. Maybe they need to bring in an assistant coach who cleans up all the little things. I don't know. That's could be the head coach's job. So it's, I don't know. I feel like they're kind of chasing their tail on us a little bit.
I think they could probably benefit from somebody on the outside who doesn't know Scott as well, you know, coming in and saying, wait a second, this isn't as polished as you think it is. You know, this is not, you think that this, you know, cause Scott's not, he's not making mistakes because he's not working at it. Right. I think he could benefit from somebody coming in, you know, and saying, Scott, I know you think you're doing a great job in this area, but you're not, you're only doing a good job or a mediocre job in this area. And thus it's something that you need to pay more attention to. I mean, typically the faults, especially when it comes to a person like Scott Frost, who, you know, this job means more to him than anything in the world. I think, I think if you, it's not for lack of effort. I think it's probably just a different perspective that he needs. And I'm not sure he's getting that from the people on his staff.
Yep. I think there'll be some sort of resolution relatively soon. I just, again, I think the thing, like, part of what happens sometimes within the program is I think there's just a hesitancy to talk about the things that, like, just happen and be honest. Like, It was hard for them to transition from Troy Walters to Matt Lubick last year in a way that any of us would recognize. Like, it was, you know, there were reports of Mickey Joseph turning down a job that Walters currently had, and then they announced Walters was gone, and then they announced that Lubick was in, and an hour later, and, you know, like, they're just not always great with that process. You know, Rutledge is the one who's announcing that he's been let go and then talking about it. It's like, it's just sort of a, you know, it's okay to say you let a guy go. I mean, that happens all the time in the business. It's okay to say somebody transferred. Those things, it's just those small aspects of kind of getting over some of the negative. You just gotta deal with it. And we'll see how they handle it, and if they're able to hire, they have time to hire somebody. They have a month, essentially 2 months, so it's not like they have to have somebody right away, to come in like this week and take the job. But we'll kind of assess what happens there. Evan, I want to go to you to baseball. The basketball I can talk about briefly, just what I think might happen, but. In terms of baseball, you wrote a story today about the Big Ten Baseball Conference having a conference-only schedule, or likely having a conference-only schedule, and how that might hurt their chances in the postseason. Why?
Right. Well, first of all, it's in huge contrast to pretty much every other league out there. I mean, the Big 12 this week adopted a pretty normal schedule. The SEC is going business as usual. The Missouri Valley, I mean, all just go down the line of top RPI leagues in college baseball. And they're at the very least leaving it to schools to schedule non-conference games if they so choose. But yeah, for the Big Ten, it's going to hurt, because this is a league that's been on the rise the last handful of years. They had 5 bids into the NCAA tournament last year, which tied their most in their league history. But when you start to look at it and you go down the list of non-conference strength of schedules, I mean, that's where the league has made its move. I mean, they're as Nebraska fans know, they, you know, league teams travel for 3 weeks or a month starting in mid-February. They head south and they play oftentimes, you know, major Southern powers. And if you can win one game down there, if you can win 2 games in a couple of weeks against a couple of good teams, that sets you up for the conference. That gives you some margin for error. And so the Big Ten, which hasn't announced anything, by the way, this was the conference only thing was reported by D1 baseball back in November. It's just been internal discussions. Nebraska coaches, administrators, they don't know what or when things are coming out. So everyone's just kind of waiting. But if it goes this way, and if it officially turns out to be that Nebraska is just playing conference only and the rest of the league is doing the same, that's killer for your RPI. I mean, half the league often is a drain on your RPI anyway. I mean, the Michigan States, the Rutgers, the Northwesterns of the world were always series that if you're a team like Nebraska, you have to win the series at the very least not to take an RPI hit. So it's going to be tough. I'm talking to a couple national media guys. They were saying, you know, committee members that decide these things, they're going to have to take a lot of liberty in terms of how they interpret what these teams can do. And you're not going to get the benefit of the doubt anymore if you're in Illinois or if you're in Iowa or whoever, and you're, you know, a couple games hovering around 500 in the Big Ten. It's just not going to happen. And so just real quick, before the 2020 season got canceled, like, here's an example of how important it is. So Illinois beat Texas A&M and Oklahoma State before this pandemic wiped out the season. Indiana took a game from LSU. Iowa beat North Carolina. Michigan beat number 2 Vanderbilt. Like, these were all wins that would have set them up again to head into the postseason. Now they don't have any of that. So it's a big deal. And I think we can talk about this too a little bit, but it's interesting when you contrast that with other sports, you know, like football, for example, doesn't hurt the Big Ten necessarily not to play non-conference. If Nebraska is not playing, you know, South Alabama, it's not the end of the world. Men's basketball is as deep as any league in the country in the Big Ten. Same thing.
But they play non-conference games.
They do. That's the difference. Yeah. But I'm saying, even if they didn't, those are all leagues that are going to get by just fine. Baseball, no team in a preseason top 25. That's going to be a killer for those guys this spring.
Well, Evan, here again, we talked about this. The basketball teams get to play non-conference games, but they didn't do it in football. They're not doing it in baseball. I don't understand. Like I said, the word rationale doesn't go with the word Big Ten, but
because they care about basketball. That's why.
Well, they
like it.
I get it. But here's the thing, Evan, that I think they need to answer to eventually. We went through this in football. What? There's going to be baseball series around the country that aren't played because of COVID. Teams are especially in March, they just aren't going to be able to do it. So why not let, if Nebraska loses a series, why not let them go play K-State or KU or Creighton? Why not let them go play somebody else for the weekend just to get games in? I'm sure that there's no flexibility there. I'm sure they're not thinking about that, but damn it, they should. It's just ridiculous. So especially in baseball, when you need to get on a bus and go play somebody close. So it feels like football all over again, you know. And they got lucky in football. Ohio State, they got voted in by the league to play the championship game and go to the playoff, but it ain't gonna happen in baseball.
If I had to play a hunch, I think my sense is that it's about the dynamics of the decision making and the assumption that, well, volleyball's fine, which they are. Well, wrestling's fine, which it is.
Yep.
Baseball can do it, right? 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 There's nobody in there fighting for something else. Like, it's a league that is generally inattentive to a whole bunch of things because it's not built to care about that kind of stuff. It's built as a basketball league. That's what I know the commissioner cares about, that because he was a former basketball player and loves it, and they want to win a basketball title. So you have to play non-conference games to do that. And then I think they went to the other sports and they're like, look, we got to get through this stuff. We have other things to do. And I think baseball just kind of got left out on the rocks. The College World Series announced that it's going to start on Friday 18th, and they're going to start their best of three series on Saturday, June 25th. So they're going to start it on a weekend.
In 2022.
Yeah. No. Not right away. We don't know if there's a CWS coming up in this year, do we? Or do we?
Not yet. I don't think so. Not officially. I love the format, by the way. I mean, why take the weekend off and then play your most prominent series in your sport on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday?
Because that's what ESPN wanted, I'm sure. Right. Now they won't. Now they're not listening to ESPN anymore. That's good. I'm glad.
Sam, the only way to persuade the Big Ten that they're making a mistake on this baseball thing is to show them that Ohio State football needs Ohio State baseball to have non-conference games to compete with Alabama. So
that's right. That's right.
Well, they have that. They have that in volleyball.
Yep.
What happens if some of those teams lose games? And
they'll be fine. Their reputation's pristine. That's the thing, is that the volleyball and baseball are different because of the reputation of the leagues. And you have to be sensitive to the shifting dynamics league to league. Softball's the same way. If softball goes conference only, it's going to hurt them. There's like three teams in the Big Ten that have respect. The rest don't. Not like Alabama and Florida and all. It's going to be 11 teams from the SEC. And, well, I don't know, maybe the Pac-12 will go conference only, but that's fine for the Pac-12.
Well, and that's the thing, Sam. It's very easy. It also gives the committee, the selection committee, an excuse.
Right.
You know, if somebody's on the fence, if Nebraska is a bubble team, it becomes very easy because they're always looking for rationale, you know, to put one team in versus one team out. And some of the, you know, a committee member will you know, sometimes come up with something that's just ridiculous because they need a reason to think what they think. And this gives everybody a real easy reason. It's like, well, they only played 22 games. How are we supposed to put a team in there that only played 22 games? Mm-hmm.
They just had a team in the championship series 2 years ago. And, I mean, they need some people in the Big Ten who follow sports, okay? They need they've got, like Evan said, they've got teams in there. The Big Ten baseball is getting a lot better.
Who's the baseball administrator, Evan, for the Big Ten?
Couldn't even tell you, to be honest.
Yeah, there you go.
And when the tournament's in Omaha, it's run by, not prominent folks from the Big Ten.
You're right. It's just
especially compared to the old Big 12 setup, where I mean, it was a big deal in the Big 12. Not the case.
What you guys said. It's not a big enough deal, but they're getting better, and they have an opportunity here. I love the Bruce Rasmussen plan. Put all the football schools in one big region, or not region, but put all those guys together and let them play each other and figure out their playoff and their championship. And put all the basketball and baseball and everybody else in the old Big 8 or Big 12, where they just, and you sit back in your region, let the old Big 10 be the old Big 10 in basketball. And put, you know, and let everybody get back on the regional games, get on buses, save money, all that stuff. I don't think it'll happen in basketball, but I would love that.
You know what? It's a little reminiscent. It reminds me of youth sports in some ways, where, for 90% of the participants in youth sports, the old model is just fine. You know, it's like do the little rec league with the weekend games and the one night a week practice. It's the 10% at the top, you know, that forces everybody else to change. And that's the same way it's been with college football. I mean, if college football is the 10% at the top that has forced everybody else into lives that aren't nearly as natural or as enjoyable. And I agree. I think it needs to be you know, you use the golf thing as an example too. It's the guys who hit it 350 are causing changes in the game for everybody else, and that's only a very small portion of the population. It's like, let's just separate these two into different buckets. Let's let college football do what they do, and let's let everybody else focus on the neighborhood. There's no freaking reason that Nebraska should be playing Rutgers in volleyball, soccer, softball, anything else. Nebraska should be playing Iowa State, Kansas State, Creighton, et cetera. And yet we've entered this world where we feel like, you know, every program on campus has to be a national entity that travels everywhere and plays everybody. And it's just foolish. It's financially foolish, and it's a pain for fans. It's a pain for players. They really need to go back to the old model for most of the sports.
Yep. Yeah. They probably have some challenges there, but that's an interesting thought. Let's go to the question on the basketball thing really quickly. They're on a COVID pause. They've been on that really since a series of positive tests came back on Friday and Saturday of last week. They announced it on Sunday. It is possible that Nebraska can return this coming Sunday in preparation for a January 30th game against Penn State. I don't know that that'll happen. You know, they're going to be really judicious and cautious at this point. Question that we'll have to ask Hoiberg at the appropriate time is whether or not they think if they had just paused for a full week when they paused for 2 days after in postponing the Purdue game, whether they would have had this happen or not. Because what they did is Ivan Wadrago test positive on January 4th. They pause for 2 days. They go back to practice on Thursday. They practice through that weekend. They play Indiana on January 10th. And after that, they get positive tests, and the tests go up from there. So, like, what happened and how do you rectify that? I think that's a question that we'll have to ask him. Or maybe those things are unrelated. It's hard to say. But as it stands, the earliest they're going to play a game is January 30th. I don't think they're going to reschedule anything before that. And I'd be surprised, actually, if the January 30th game was played. So I guess we'll find out. Let's go to these questions that I got on Twitter. I had this is a pretty good one. Where is it? If the offense stagnates again in 2021, how much will the defense need to improve to get to a bowl? That's from Greg. Ah.
If the offense is the same as last year or worse?
Yes.
Well, I had the numbers. I believe I have them on the top of my head again. The defense last year allowed 29 points a game. Offense scored 23. That doesn't really work. No. The defense would have to give up less than three touchdowns a game if the offense scores that many points a game. That schedule, you think that's going to happen? I think the offense needs to improve a bunch.
Yeah.
They're not going to go to a bowl.
Now we have to take into account that teams almost always score more points in their limited sample size of non-conference games versus conference games because they are playing a rummy. So you always take that into account. Nebraska, for example, averaged 36.7 points against non-conference teams in 2019. Against conference teams in 2019, they averaged 25.1. So there's always a game in there that helps skew the numbers. So Nebraska's offense averaged 25.1 points per game in conference play last year. This year it went down to 23.1. So their offense did get worse, but by 2 points.
Better put up 60 against Southeastern Louisiana, baby.
Yes. Well, that's my point, is that will happen, because when you start scheduling FCS teams late in the season, you're going to kick their butt. Like, that's what happens, is that's what the SEC has learned. Is schedule the games late, because by the time you play them, they're beat up and they're not, you know, they're 4-3 and they're not inspired to play you anymore. And you just kick the crap out of them. That's what happened when Nebraska played Bethune-Cookman. You know, I mean, they weren't playing a fresh team. They were playing a team that was already beat up, and they did whatever they wanted. So,
yeah.
Okay, so they got to, the defense has got to get that much better. I think that's fair. Yeah.
My answer would be they need to do what they were really emphasizing and designed to do, which was force turnovers. I mean, seven takeaways in eight games is what they forced this year. Two fumbles, five interceptions, and the offense turned it over 18 times. So you're talking a minus 11 turnover margin. That's a recipe for disaster most weeks. Obviously, the Illinois game was kind of the low light of that. But, you know, if the defense, I think if they can continue to progress how they did, kind of bending, not breaking, giving up field goals instead of touchdowns as they did, and you can add to that, you know, a little bit more of a disruptive play in terms of getting the ball back to the offense, giving them that extra chance or two that it's clear that they need at this point, I think that could flip a couple of games for Nebraska. So that's just been as good as the defense has been. I think that's the big area that you can still look at and say that's where they need to improve is not just forcing punts, but those quick change of possession type situations that gets it back to the offense.
So let me ask, that's a good answer. We got three different questions. So I got two in DMs and one publicly about Nebraska's tight ends, specifically Thomas Fedoni and how he will be used and the value he has. I'd like to expand that to all of the tight ends. Is Nebraska's tight end room now the kind of room that can be a primary target on the Nebraska offense? And how will Thomas Fedoni be used?
Well,
you answer that, Sam.
Anybody can talk. I have a thought, but I'll let
Sam answer. No, we discussed this last time we talked. I mean, how Nebraska's tight ends are sort of West Coast offense style at this point, and I think it does cover up some of their weaknesses at wide receiver. You know, you saw that this past year where they relied, you know, more heavily on the tight ends than they probably would have had they been stocked at wide receiver. So I think it's a position that they can lean on. Fedoni, I don't know. It's hard to anticipate, you know, the versatile ways that you can use a tight end, especially his first year on campus. But I would imagine that when you have one of the top recruits at a position, they are going to do everything possible to showcase him, in part because I think it's a strong message to other recruits that, hey, look, you can come here and play, you know, and get four or five touches a game. So we'll see. I mean, there's a long way to go and you got to see how he develops, but I think he is the versatile type guy where maybe you do some things schematically that you wouldn't do for others.
I would say that Fedoni has probably enough speed and ball skills and catch radius that you can flex him out, use him in slot fades, which they used to use Jordan Akins at UCF with. Nebraska likes to use a lot of over routes sometimes with their tight ends. And so what they'll do is they'll have a play action fake, and then they'll take that tight end and they'll kind of run him kind of across the field. I'm not saying he's Tyreek Hill or anything, but they'll run him across the field and try to get him maybe in that second level behind the linebackers. And I think Fedoni would be good at that. I think Austin Allen got better there. And then they want their tight ends to be in the short passing game too, which they use them pretty well already there. So they did a nice job last season of using Stoll and Allen in that role where you just a quick throw, get 5-6 yards. And then they tried to use Travis Vokolek as more of a downfield threat, and it didn't always work, but I think they'll get better there with him. And then I think Fedoni's going to be that guy too. Chris Hickman's probably going to move back to tight end, and Hickman is similar to Fedoni. And so you have a pretty full room there. And, you know, you can use a little bit of H-back. Some, you know, I don't know that they have a classic H-back tight end per se in their offense. They probably need somebody who's a little bit more of a runner. Maybe that's Fedoni, maybe not. But I think they can shift some of their offensive focus to that position and perhaps, again, a little bit away from 5'9" slot receiver who also plays running back. I'm not sure that that's quite as popular at this very moment as it was when DeAnthony Thomas was doing it, you know, 7 years ago. I just don't know that that NFL role is as pronounced. The best player in the NFL, not morally, but you know, in that role is Tyreek Hill. And Hill carries it maybe once or twice a game, and it's in more of a Rondell Moore jet sweep fashion. So Hill has become more of the physical template that people are looking for, and there's not necessarily a ton of versatility there. They're not looking for Darren Sproles. They're looking more for the Tyreek Hill type. And I don't know if Wandale Robinson is that or not, but Tyreek Hill caught a lot of passes and he ran a lot of deep routes. So that's something to consider. Next question. Do you think the coaches, quote, get it regarding what we talk about in the fan base about stubborn adherence to the system, special teams, no QB development, talent not matching results on the field, generally weak player development? Or do they even hear it? Do they care what we see? That's a loaded question. And of course, that's a question for the coaches more than it is for us. But what do you think there's a connection? Like, do you think the coaches are connected in that way to the fan base? Like, do they understand that there's more consternation out there than there's actually been in a while?
Oh, I mean, I think the fans aren't seeing anything the coaches don't see. I mean, the coaches see it all. The coaches have a different opinion about how things are probably going to get fixed. Is the question, do the coaches know we're upset? Is that what the question is? I don't know, but I think they care, but they're not obsessed with the fans, you know, their criticisms. I mean, I don't know. It's, yeah, I think the coaches see all the problems, but I hope they're trying to fix them, but the fans want them done now. And that these guys, this coaching staff hasn't been able to do that. So I think I understand the question.
I'm very prone to a clunky metaphor. And so try to stick with me. Okay. Have you ever been on a hike, with a group of people and the hike leader is like, you know, 50 yards up ahead and you're clearly lost. The hike leader knows you're lost, right? He's certainly familiar with the situation. And yet at the same time, he can probably see the way out a little bit earlier than the pack can because he's 50 yards ahead. So there's a sort of a positive and negative to it. And at the same time, I think he's probably aware, he can probably hear the muttering 50 yards behind him, but he probably doesn't understand the full volume or full extent of the muttering. And I think sometimes football coaches are so focused on the hour to hour stuff that they do lose sight of the big picture stuff. And so it wouldn't surprise me if Frost and his staff are a little bit unaware of the full consternation out there. But at the same time, I think they're generally aware of it. And I think they're certainly aware that things are not going very well to this point. But I also think that they probably have a little bit more hope that there's, you know, a light coming. And, you know, generally these people are fairly optimistic and egotistical in a good way and can at least visualize a solution to the problem.
And I guess I would add, you know, even in our line of work, I don't know if you guys have ever done this, but occasionally if I'm writing a story, I'll want, you know, even my wife to read it, someone who's not invested in it, and to be like, does this make sense to you? Because I would be so immersed in whatever that it was valuable to have that outside opinion. And I think sometimes that's just human nature where you get so far down the rabbit hole in trying to fix something and trying to research something that sometimes it's hard to kind of step back and come up for air and take that global approach. And so I think I've often actually thought it would be interesting if you could take a couple knowledgeable fans and just say, hey, you know what, this afternoon you guys can sit in on the coaches meeting and like just let them kind of whatever air their grievances or put their stuff out there. And I'd be really fascinated to see if the coaches just kind of roll their eyes and say, yeah, we've heard all that, or if they would, you know, would stop and think maybe, oh, that's an interesting point. And then I think the other thing that can play into that is, you know, these coaches are part of a team. They know each other and by all accounts care about each other. And so it's harder to be critical, I think, too, when things need changing, that means that's going to affect your coworker, that's going to affect their families potentially, and all that sort of things too. So I think that's an interesting dynamic, I think, when you have maybe more of a dispassionate, objective, less educated often view from the fans and how that would clash with the coaches.
Yeah, and I'll give you two examples, Sam. I think I did a lot of reporting, you know, on, well, I wouldn't call it reporting, it's just basically statistical, you know, compilation on Nebraska's turnover problems over the last, you know, 20 years. And I don't think the coaches fully understood how bad it was. You know, I think when you're in it day to day, I think it just becomes a little bit normal. We were minus one this Saturday. Oh, we were minus two this Saturday. You know, I think it does sort of help to have an outside perspective. Your special teams analysis, I would compare the same way as another example of that, where, you know, I just don't know if you're in it every day, if you realize how bad it is sometimes. And that's part of why I think, you know, Frost would benefit from somebody coming in from the outside who he respects, who could tell him, again, I know you're trying to do this really well, but it's not, you're not doing it as well as you think you are. And I don't know if that's practical at this point in his career, or if he has, I'm sure he could find that type of guy if you paid him a couple $100,000 to do it. But I do think that sometimes an outside perspective like Evan is talking about can really help.
There's often a public policy analogy that's used. It's used in a variety of contexts, and I'll attempt to use it here for the turnover issue. If you go to a pond and you see that a fish has come up and that there's a fish sort of floating on the surface, you know, it's passed away, you know, it's dead. And most people, if you ask most people what that means, well, there was something wrong with the fish. If you go to a pond and you see that there are 40 or 50 fish that are floating on the surface of the pond, you don't think there's something wrong with each individual fish. You think there's something wrong with the pond. And when you look at Nebraska's turnover disparity over the course of not just one, but 10 years, and they won at times despite it, right? Taylor Martinez won games despite being a total turnover machine. There's something wrong with the approach, like, because you don't turn the ball over that many times over that many years in the same stinking ways and not think, okay, there's something wrong with what we're doing or how we're teaching it or how it's going. And then there is this little period of 3 years where most of the turnovers go away. They go away, or at least the fumbles do. They just disappear. I think, to me, the biggest issue is quarterback play and usage. Now, one of them is when Riley was the head coach, Tanner Lee threw interceptions like he was handing out candy. And I was told by somebody who had covered Riley a long time ago that wasn't Riley, that was Langsdorf, because every quarterback that Danny Langsdorf ever coached threw interceptions because Langsdorf was an aggressive play caller. Outside of those 3 years, fumbling has been the issue, and it's because they run their quarterbacks an obscene amount of times. They ran them, I believe, 22.3 times per game this year. It's not a surprise when you're running people who do not protect the ball for a living, when you're running them that often, it is almost certain that they will fumble once or twice per game, which is exactly what they did. I think they fumbled 11 times in the season, something like that, 11 or 12, and lost one per game. And so that's part of the issue. You have to address and resolve that specific problem.
Sam, you make a great point, and I would just ask the question because you would have a better idea than I would, and Evan would too. How often do you think Adrian Martinez gets tackled to the ground in practice Monday through Thursday?
I don't know.
From what we've seen in our handful, very little.
Yeah, I would guess the answer is less than 10 times per week. And I think it's very difficult when you're not practicing, you know, full contact. Quarterbacks, starting quarterbacks almost never practice full contact. How are you supposed to emphasize ball security if you never get hit in practice? I mean, to me, that's not, you know, and I would say Taylor Martinez falls into the same category. It's like, you know, quarterbacks are protected Monday through Friday, and for good reason. You don't want to lose your quarterback at, you know, at practice. But then when you, you know, when you run him 20 times a game on Saturday afternoon, he's not used to, you know, getting the ball ripped. He's not used to getting hit. And I think if Nebraska is going to continue to do what it does, then it probably needs to modify its practice regimen.
Yeah. I mean, I think some of it is that the quarterback play as it relates to distributing the football isn't good enough. And then they just can't hand the ball off to a running back and block it with their offensive line. We put a lot of it on the quarterbacks, but at the end of the day, the other pieces got to get better. If you want to hand the football off, when Alabama hands it off to Najee Harris, look, is Najee Harris a good player? Yeah, he's good. But they've had a lot of really good Alabama running backs, and only one, that being Derrick Henry, maybe Josh Jacobs, has been elite at the NFL level. That's because the line in front of them was really, really good. And you don't have to have a five-star running back. Alabama does, but they don't have to in order to be really, really good at running the football. And they don't have to put their quarterback in harm's way all the time. That's another one. All right, two more questions. What we all know what the problems have been for Husker football. What are three or four reasons to think things might get better in 2021? Should we spend this offseason being hopeful or wallowing in our grievance?
Well, okay, if you guys are going to make me do it, you know how optimistic I always am. I think, you know, we talked about this last week a little bit. Nebraska has the deepest defense they've had in 20 years. I'm not saying it's going to be the best, but it's
– But yeah, I get you.
But I think from a personnel standpoint, it's probably the deepest. And that's – hey, man, that's reason for serious optimism. If you watched Northwestern football this past year, you saw what a really good defense can do in a pretty, I don't want to say mediocre, but a pretty balanced division. I think you can win a lot of close games if your offense, you know, helps you out. And Evan described that, you know, that formula a little bit ago. So, I think there's serious optimism there. You know, I think there's always optimism that Adrian Martinez, if he's the starting quarterback, is gonna make, you know, make a little bit of a jump in year four. But for me, it's primarily the fact that Nebraska, I think, has a legitimate Big Ten defense, and I would not have said that a year ago.
Anything to add, Evan?
You know, I mean, I agree with what Dirk's saying there. I guess I would say, as much as the schedule in 2021 is a bear, and it is. If Nebraska does figure some things out, if the special teams can just be mediocre instead of a hindrance, if the offense can just be nationally average, and Nebraska can win a couple of those games, they're going to come against some pretty notable opponents along the way. I mean, if you chart a course to six wins, at least a couple of those are going to make your head turn when they happen. So I suppose that's what I would look at is, if Nebraska, this is an opportunity for them to really make a statement this year, and they may not, and it may be another losing season, but the opportunity certainly is there, is in front of these guys, that if they can make those improvements and can rely on the defense the way Dirk was saying too, it's the kind of thing that that could turn quick potentially.
I can sign on to those things. I would say that the thing, and this is something we have to sort of confirm a little bit more with Frost. I think there's probably going to be a leveling and understanding that now's the time. And it's, I think necessity and urgency have a way sometimes of, and we all know this as reporters on deadline, they actually have a way of producing some good things. And I think, this was a program that that needed some urgency, and it has it now. And no one's gonna put a lipstick on on it. No one's going to say, you know, it's just going to be, we got to do it now. It's not going to be a.
Sam, where is that urgency coming from? Are you sure it's there?
Well, that's what I say when we've got to confirm it with Frost. I think he's probably got some internal urgency to.
Well, I mean.
Bowl game. Now, again, I mean, I think I'm not talking about going 9-3. That'll be hard. Although, you know, the schedule isn't. I mean, Michigan and Michigan State are not that hard of teams. Okay. So it's man. I mean, it's not like it's just, oh my God, but I just think there'll be a sense of, you know, and that's something I want to ask Frost. Like, where was your urgency the day you guys were playing Minnesota? Like, what was that? What
happened? That's what I'm talking about. There is no, until we see urgency, there is no urgency. I mean, we haven't seen it yet. So there's got to be discipline. They've got to play cleaner. And having in year four, having, you know, mediocre special teams and average offense isn't good enough. It's right. Got to be better by now. I think the schedule is going to be like this every year. I mean, you're basically going to play Michigan and Ohio State or somebody. It's going to be Penn State. It's Indiana is arguably is better than Michigan right now. I mean, it's
yeah.
Here comes Brett Bielema. I mean, in Illinois. So I think what makes tough next year is going to OU, and then you got Lance Leipold coming to town early, and they averaged 43 points a game last year. So, but it's going to be the same schedule basically every year in the Big Ten and the Big Ten West. And I just, what I want to see next year is what I wanted to see every year is play smart football. Be well coached and don't get out coached. And I, you know, they do have strengths. Their defense is a strength, I think. Can they find their strength on offense? I really want to see that next year. I mean, okay, you got a quarterback who runs, okay, fumbles, but sometimes when he runs, there are good things happen. I loved your idea, Sam, of going more to that run game with the quarterback. And who's your running back next year?
Yeah, I don't think they should run it more with the quarterback. I really don't.
But
I think they should run it less.
But they
fewer times.
Well, I would say if you're passing it, who are you passing to?
Right, right.
You don't have the receiver. They don't have the pieces in place yet to run the passing offense.
Yeah, that's fair.
So
that's fair.
What are you doing? I mean,
punt on third down. Punt on third down.
You got it. Look, I mean,
you got to
get better. You can talk about it a lot of different ways. And again, Frost and Lubick have to speak to, but you have to get better at being able to say on this play, we're going to give the ball to the running back. It's not going to be a read. It's not going to be we could give it to him. We could throw it down the line and to a fumble that turns into a fumble that should have been a pass or whatever. You just hand the ball to the running back and he gains 5 yards. And there has to be an ability to be able to do that. And one of the things, Tom, that you've brought up many times, and I appreciate it, is look like you're coached. And I think one of the challenges that fans have about Nebraska's offense is that, and we got a question about this as it relates to audibles. People wonder if Nebraska's quarterback's audible. They don't audible very much. And the reason they don't is because every play is built to adjust to whatever the defense does. And so each play is either a double or a triple option, you know, in the sense that you could hand it, you could keep it, you could throw it. And sometimes when you watch a Nebraska offensive play, there's about three different things going on. And it doesn't look like 11 guys are all doing the same thing because they're kind of trying to do two or three things at once. And when you're really good and you have really good players, that all looks really pretty. Alabama does it all the time. Ohio State does it all the time. The challenge that Nebraska has is if they can't make that thing work, which is kind of the crux of Frost's offense, if they can't make all the parts of a play work where defense takes away this read, but the other play isn't there because Nebraska screwed up the execution, then do they have to go to something that's a little bit more like what Iowa or Wisconsin does and just say, hey, we're just going to run the play that we're going to run, and you're going to execute it the best we can, and you're going to stop it or not. And Nebraska's offense is different. It does this. You know, we could do this.
And that's what Frost did when he played. When he was a player, they had three or four plays, and they ran them, and nobody could stop him. That's the secret to Nebraska football.
Correct.
So we did this with.
But that's not what they do now.
Callahan.
They run these
packs. Offense was too much. Well, if they can't execute Frost's offense, then he needs to give them something that they can execute. So,
hey, Sam, I got to duck out. I got a phone interview at 11:15. So
take care. All
right. Hey, Dirk.
Thanks, guys.
All I will say is I think that's part. When I think of like people watching Nebraska's offense and going, what are they doing there? Some of it is that seriously, like some of it is they're running package plays and they're, that's, you know, like the Luke McCaffrey play to start the Illinois game was a backside, whatever, a backside zone, which he didn't hand it off to Marvin Scott. He pulled it. He ran down the line and instead of running the ball, he threw it basically into a crowd of people. Wandale Robinson wasn't open. It was the first play of the game. And you'll hear people say, well, you know, that was a pretty basic play. I mean, this, and this. Well, okay. Football guy says it's a pretty basic play. But when a fan who used to watch, you know, 30 years ago watches and goes, what is that? It's this combination of plays. It's like we were all joking when in the press box at Rutgers. Well, in the first play of the game, they're going to hand it to Dedrick Mills. They didn't. They threw it to Austin Allen because that's just how their offense works. They look at the read. They process the read. Then they make the decision. That's why their quarterbacks have to be, quote-unquote, fast blinkers. I just don't see an offense that can consistently do that execution-wise, and that's why people are frustrated because they watch the offense and they're like, what the hell was that? That's why it looks the way it does sometimes.
Well, and I'll just end on this. Well, one, when I talk about running the quarterback, I think it should be a wrinkle in the offense. I don't think it should be the offense. I think it should be like the Ohio State game at home 2 years ago, when right in the middle of the second quarter, he came out with this option I formation thing.
Right.
And Ohio State was scrambling. They were running around with their, you know, they had no idea what was happening. I think you could cause some problems in the Big Ten with the running, with the quarterback run game.
Sure.
As sort of a thing you throw out there, just to throw them off a little bit. But again, if you're going to throw the ball, and I don't mind that because I think everybody in the Big Ten plays with tight ends and linebackers and fullbacks and stuff. But you got to have the personnel to do it and get these kids on the field. I mean, maybe they're transferring because they don't get on the field. Get the offense where these kids can get on the field early. So,
no, I get it.
I don't have all the answers.
All right, last question and then we'll go. Would you rather drive a Zamboni during the Stanley Cup or ride in a sidecar, motorcycle sidecar on a dirt road in western Nebraska while eating a ham sandwich?
Okay.
Which would you rather do?
Is there a third choice?
No.
I was in a car in western Nebraska going down dirt roads with my wife's uncle out in Alliance, and he got us to the Chimney Rock. Well, I was to Chimney Rock about an hour drive with no signs. He just turned on dirt road after dirt road. I was scared to death. So I'll go with the Zamboni, but only if I can have the little Zamboni like the fish guy at UNO.
I've always been too tall to fit into sidecars anyway, so that doesn't sound all that comfortable. so I'll go with the Zamboni too. I always, as a kid, loved those things and just watching them. It was, you know, like, I don't know, watching a flame. It was just kind of entrancing. So give me the Zamboni. Yeah, love that.
I'll take a Zamboni too. I don't know that I'd fit in a sidecar. And I'm, you know, ham sandwiches are fine, but they're not my preferred sandwich.
I wasn't complaining about that.
Yeah, I'll take a ham sandwich.
Can I ask you guys one of these other questions quick? This one I thought was fascinating. Do we need to sacrifice a chicken or a goat or something for the curse to be lifted off the Husker Hoops program? So, like, as a Cubs fan, you know, they blew up the Bartman ball a handful of years ago to, like, help reverse the curse. What's like, I don't know, an artifact or something maybe be blown up, or I don't know, how would you guys mystically go about reversing the curse of Nebraska basketball?
Oh boy.
Another five-star recruit probably. I don't know. I mean, let me think here for a second. Maybe one of the what you could do is you could gather up all the cobwebs that used to grow on Devaney Sports Center when the basketball team was there and burn those. Like, they're not really there anymore. They've really spruced that place up since they renovated it. Like, it's a lot nicer now, but like when Doc Sadler's teams were in there at the end and they didn't really like the place anymore, you could walk up to a door and you'd just be like, there's a lot of cobwebs up there. Like, it's people weren't clean. And it just wasn't a good place for basketball. So probably something along those. I remember a recruit walking up. I was going to watch practice and a recruit was in town and there were like cobwebs in the corner. And I'm like, oh boy, can I say this, this may sound odd, but in covering the team this year, there's no fans in the arena. It's obviously a disadvantage for Nebraska, but you actually see the financial and monetary and give a crap factor disparity between Nebraska and other teams in the Big Ten. And I don't mean Fred Hoiberg. I mean the monetary commitment, because Michigan State, both of those programs rolled into Nebraska with a giant entourage of backups and assistants and trainers and what have you. They had a whole bunch of people there. And they were louder, and they had this big group of guys, and it stood out to me. Like, it was like, wow, there's the contrast between a program that expects to win and it knows it'll win, and a program that is trying to win. And I think that Nebraska's commitment obviously is improved, but you know, is it where it absolutely could be? And Fred Hoiberg is a good guy who's never going to talk Nebraska down in this way. But I'd love to pick his brain, you know, for an hour and just say, tell me the differences between Iowa State's commitment and Nebraska's commitment. And, you know, like, is it where it needs to be in order to convey to your program that you guys are big time? Because I kind of feel like Nebraska's commitment to basketball is similar to like a K-State, and K-State's been better than Nebraska, to be clear, but K-State kind of relies on having superstar players every so often. And when they don't have them, they just fall into the ocean. So it's almost like Nebraska really, really anchors itself to two or three great players. And if they don't have those players, their teams just really struggle because they don't have that institutional standard or commitment to the sport.
Yep.
Does that sound right, Tom? Like, that Kansas State's is distinctly not Kansas or Missouri in its institutional commitment to the sport.
I mean, it's been 30 years since I've been around that program a lot, but I used to cover them. K-State fans care more about basketball. It's in their history. It's in their heritage. But Bill Snyder changed a lot of that. That was one of the reasons Lon Kruger left. Because he saw it coming, that Snyder was getting all the power, and they cared more about football. They became a football school.
Right.
It doesn't mean they've had good basketball teams since then. Certainly, they hired Bob Huggins. I mean, that was a big deal, and they made they ended up getting Frank Martin out of the deal, but you know, it's. I think there's something to that, but I think that's the Big Ten. I mean, Nebraska could take if they look around the Big Ten and how they do basketball, they could take that. I can learn a lot. I mean, they really should emulate a lot of these Big Ten schools in basketball. They do care. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
A lot of places it's bigger than the football.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no reason why you can't do it here, but you've got to care. You're absolutely right. And so, but it starts at the top. And, you know, how much is Moose putting on it? And you just hire Hoiberg and say, okay, go do it. You know, you can't do that. You got to be on top of it. So that's a good question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we'll see. We'll see what happens with them. That's our podcast for this week. Next week we'll be back, hopefully, to talk a whole lot more football and hopefully an updated timeline on Nebraska basketball. And who knows, maybe we'll get a little something on women's basketball or volleyball or something else. We'll have another guest. We'll have some recruiting stuff this week. Look for that. We'll have a feature on a couple of top prospects in the state and maybe a few other things. I appreciate your time, everybody. Thanks for Evan Bland, Tom Chattel, now the dearly departed Dirk Jatlin, who had a phone interview. I'm Sam McEwen. Thanks for listening.